What's up, everybody? This is Ryan Staley, and you are listening to the Sales and Marketing Built Freedom Podcast, where we share with you the underground ninja skills and tactics that the top sales and marketing leaders are using to create financial and lifestyle freedom. And the question that everybody is asking is, how do I create financial and lifestyle freedom for me? That is the question, and this show is the answer. All right, we are live. I have a very, very special guest with me today. I have Terry Jones. So Terry is best known for founding Travelocity as well as Kayak, in which he took them to a $1.8 billion exit. That's Trace Comas right there, $1 billion exit. Terry Jones has become a powerful voice in the world of entrepreneurship through numerous speaking engagement and publication of his books, Innovation On and Disruption Off, which I absolutely love. At the same time, he's a managing principal of On Inc., has a consultancy. He's now on 20 boards, which I thought was amazing, man, that you're on 20 boards. I don't know how you find
the time. I've been on 20 boards. I'm only on five right
now. Okay. I was like, wow, how are you doing 20? Okay, so
I couldn't. Yeah, I'd never do anything else.
And so he's also the holder of several patents, which we didn't even get a chance to talk about, man, that as well. So that's pretty cool. So welcome. Happy to have you on, Terry. Really looking forward to our conversation today, man.
Great to be with you, Ryan.
Yeah. So it was great chatting with you a little bit before and just kind of getting your viewpoint on what's happening, what's going on right now in the world and, you know, kind of your history as well. So, however, the listeners did not get that chance to really sit back and hear about your history. So can you just walk everyone through your superhero origin story and kind of how you came about and how this man, Terry Jones, was created?
Yeah, I arrived on a small spacecraft from a faraway planet. No. Well, I didn't know, you know, I went to college and majored in history, and when college was finished, I was sure I was going to go to Vietnam. I had a low draft number, and I got rejected by the draft because of my back. So I didn't have to go to Vietnam, thank God. And my college roommate, dad, was a pilot for Transworld Airlines, which at the time was the second largest airline in the world. He said, I have a free pass, and I'm going to lose it if I go to grad school. So I'm going to spend a year going around the world. And another friend and I said, well, we'll go with you. So we spent a year traveling around the world. I recommend it to anybody who can do it when they get out of school. You'll never get that chance again. Go travel, learn about other cultures. I came back and said, I want to get in the travel business. So I went to school at night to learn how to be a travel agent, learn how to write tickets and compute fares. There were no computers in those days. Went to work for a travel company. I was the only guy who spoke English as a native language. You know, we had the Polish desk and the Russian desk and the Spanish desk. I was a receptionist. And 6 months in, my manager said, let's go do a startup. So we quit. And we opened a travel company focused on Eastern Europe and the USSR, which was booming at the time. And so I spent 5 years traveling back and forth to Russia. We built a big business. We became the 50th largest travel company in the U.S. in 5 years. But during that time, I got into computing. And I jumped to the computer company that we were using that was selling computers to travel agents. Mm-hmm. So I was in sales. And I even did installations. So I'd install the software and then make the sale and teach them how to do accounting. And after about 6 months, that company, we sold it to American Airlines. So suddenly I was in American Airlines. And after a year and a half, I got named president of that division and then started working my way up in marketing. And then after, I don't know, 4 or 5 years in marketing, my boss said, well, we're going to send you over to IT and you're going to run application development. I said, I don't know anything about that. They said, you'll do fine. So I had 500 developers. And then after 3 years, they said, we're going to put you in charge of computer operations. And that was 2,000 people, a $300 million budget. I said, I don't know anything about computer apps. Oh, yeah, you'll be fine. So I did that. And then I became chief information officer of American Airlines Sabre. And while I was doing that, we had this little online system that was on AOL and CompuServe, Prodigy. And the travel agents, who were big customers of the airline, of course, and we automated them, woke up to the fact that we had an online product. And they said, you should shut that off. You're selling bullets to the enemy. People are going to go direct and make their own bookings. Turn it off. And our chairman said, no, somebody's going to do it. It should be us. Give it to Jones. He's over in IT. He used to be a travel agent. We'll hide it over there. So the first thing I did, it was 1996, was put it on the internet. The internet had just been deregulated, and that became Travelocity.com. So that was really entrepreneurship, figuring out how to build that against a lot of opposition in the company, because, of course, we were competing with our major customer, travel agents. And my whole book on innovation is about that entrepreneurship. So we built it up and took it public. We had a $1 billion IPO and ran it as a public company for several years. And then eventually Sabre, the computer division of American, decided it was too important to be public. They wanted to own it. So they bought it back. And, you know, we were the largest for a long time, bigger than Expedia. And, of course, bigger than Priceline, which is now Booking.com, who's the biggest. When they bought it back and took it private, I bailed because I said, you guys are going to screw this up, which they did. They took a $1 billion company and later sold it to Expedia for $280 million.
They
put it back in the corporate world. So they broke it up as a company, and they sent ops to ops, and IT went back to IT, and accounting went to accounting, and it wasn't a company anymore. And it couldn't compete with Expedia, which was a nimble startup. Mm-hmm. And a lot of people don't know Expedia was started by Microsoft. So here you had, you know, Microsoft fighting with American Airlines. It was sort of Battle of the Titans. Mm-hmm. So then I became a speaker and an author, and I started joining boards. And I was working at a VC company, General Catalyst in Boston, helping them with travel investments. And we kind of wondered why there wasn't vertical search in travel. And we said, maybe there should be a vertical search company. We looked at a few, and Joel Cutler, the real visionary VC there, said, I think I want to fund this. So he went out and he found the CIO and the CEO, and I became the chairman, and we started Kayak.com, and really the first vertical search for travel. And that was a great 8-year ride as chairman. And as you said, we took it public, and then we sold it to Priceline for $1.8 billion. So that was a great ride. And then I did more boards, and as you and I just discussed, I got a call one day from the chairman of IBM who said, would you come up and teach IBM Watson about travel? That turned into an investment in a company called Wayblazer, which ran for 4 years, unfortunately failed. It happens with startups. I've done 5 now. We were just too early with AI and travel, but learned a lot about AI. And, you know, now I'm still speaking and writing and doing board work and some investing and a lot of mentoring. So I'm on a lot of advisory boards.
That's fantastic. I mean, and like I told you when we first started talking, just the diversity of experiences that you've had is, I mean, if there's a fly on the wall for some of the things that you kind of saw and went through, I'm sure there's some amazing stories. So let me ask you, what's that?
There are a few. Yeah.
Well, so what was it like for you emotionally to go through all that? Like, and it sounds like you just kind of kept leveling up in different areas and they led to new opportunities. So however, like, I'm sure there was some hard times or possibly some dark times when you were trying to create all that. So what was that like?
I mean, look, leaving Travelocity was a very difficult decision. I could have stayed, and they wanted me to stay, but it just didn't make sense. And I said, you know, it's time for a change. And the chairman of American said, you're 55, you know, what are you going to do? And I said, oh, I'll figure out something. And, you know, I figured out this great career where I could be a speaker and a board member. And I did consulting for several years. I wrote 2 books. You know, I think what's key is being curious. And I'm always curious about new things. I'm constantly reading And one of the great things about speaking as I do now on disruption, my new book is Disruption Off, available on Amazon, is I speak to so many different industries. So, you know, whether it's I just talked to the largest water company in the world, or a tech company or a security company, you can always learn about their business when you go to their conference or when you make a speech. And you find all the parallels. And that's what's fun about speaking. So when I talk about technology, and you know, I've got an upcoming speech at Couchbase, big database company. Well, I'm going to talk about technology in other businesses and let them put the points together in their head, because that's when you remember. So I might talk about drones in the oil industry, or AI, you know, supporting the financial industry or something else, and let them think about, well, I could do that if I did this. So, you know, success, particularly in technology, it is about being curious enough to put different pieces together in a new way to create more value. And that's what I think I've done in my career.
Have you read the book, The Innovation Secrets of Steve Jobs?
No, I've read his biography and some other books, but I haven't. That's okay. A good one. I should pick it up.
That book's been recommended to me numerous times, and I ordered The Presentation Secrets of Steve Jobs, but I heard The Innovation Secrets of Steve Jobs is absolutely amazing. So it just got me thinking of that when you're talking about like having unrelated topics or areas trigger like actions in there. So,
well, yeah, innovation, you know, what I say in my book is that culture and team are the two most important parts. You know, creating a culture where you allow failure is critical. And a lot of businesses don't allow failure. You know, if you fail, you get driven out. Well, kill projects, not people. Usually it's the project that failed, not the person. But if you kill people, then you won't get any more innovation. So, you know, culture and having a team of people who are the glass half empty people, you know, or under the glass half full people, you know, the people who want change, the people who are driving it forward is really important.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. It looks like we have Halim on here. Halim, hello. He's saying hi in the chat. So Terry, I guess the question for you is, I mean, you're talking about, you know, disruption off, but then you talk about disruption. So walk us through that, man. Like, walk us through your view on that. And how massively it's been accelerated over the last
18 months. Yeah, it's amazing. You know, during COVID, digital disruption actually accelerated. So we're seeing, you know, amazing things where e-commerce is up 30%, Instacart hires 300,000 people, curbside pickup, grocery delivery, it's all happening at speed. You see major companies changing. Shell announced peak oil. They're going to pump less going forward. And they're installing 50,000 electric car chargers. GM announced the end of the internal combustion engine. telehealth, you know, is 70% of our doctor visits during COVID were telehealth. That's not going backwards. It'll go down, but it won't go backwards. So the kind of changes that were made will continue. And the companies who are successful coming out of COVID will be those who understand that these disruptions are permanent and they get on board. Even new business models. Philips, the lighting company, announced recently that they went to Schiphol Airport in Amsterdam. Said, we don't want to sell you light bulbs anymore. We want to sell you light. We want a 20-year contract to light the airport. And they got it. So they put in immediately bulbs that use less power because they're paying for the power, bulbs that last longer because they're paying for the bulbs. And now they have a 20-year contract for an outcome. So lots of companies like Honeywell and Rolls-Royce and others are writing contracts for outcomes. We're seeing subscriptions. You know, who ever thought we'd subscribe to razors? Now, as you can see, I don't use a razor, but a lot of people do. And, you know, billion-dollar shave company, right, through subscriptions. So new business models are here supported by new technology. The combination of AI, 5G, and IoT is revolutionizing manufacturing. I'm on the board at Boingo, and we build, you know, cellular and Wi-Fi networks, and we're finding corporations want to put in 5G networks in factories because of the low latency. They can control industrial processes in a whole new way. So lots of exciting stuff coming. my book talks about all these new technologies that are coming for you. That's the first half of the book. That's to scare the crap out of you. The second half of the book is what do you do about it? And it, again, it's really about building a culture where you take risk, because without experimentation and risk, you're just going to die in the vine, right? Mm-hmm. And what's the right culture to do that? How can you be more agile? How can you make decisions more quickly? So that's really the book, and that's really what I preach to corporations is because of quarterly earnings, you've driven innovation out of your company, and you can't do that anymore because, you know, there are 10,000 startups every year that are biting your ankles, and pretty soon one of them is going to knock you over.
It's interesting. So I got two questions for you as a follow-up to that. I mean, what's your favorite innovation, or I should say disruption, that you've seen over the last 12 months or coming over the next 12 months?
Well, you know, I think it probably is this, any business that combines artificial intelligence with the other technologies that are changing. So the combination of AI and 3D printing, for example, mm-hmm. GM just used that. They created 5,000 iterations of a seat bracket with AI, little tiny part, right? And they eventually designed this seat bracket that looks like a Klingon warship. It's really weird looking. Can only be built by a 3D printer. But guess what? It's 50% stronger and 20% lighter than the previous part. Well, imagine if all the parts in a car were 20% lighter. What would that do to mileage? Right. And people say, well, 3D printers are too slow. And I say, well, they only have to be faster than the boat from China, right, where the part was made before. So it's not going to be that fast. And so that combination is interesting. You know, the combination of IoT with AI. So at Honeywell, they have sold sensors for years. Like mm-hmm. the sensor says, oh, the compressor failed and the red light goes on. Well, now instead of that, they will tell you the compressor failed, the air conditioning went off in section 2, we've turned on the backup and dispatched service. Well, that's an outcome. That's a much higher value sale than selling a sensor. So I spent a bunch of time 2 summers ago with their sales force retraining them to sell outcomes. A very different kind of a sale. You know, it's selling SaaS. It's about customer success, not just sell the iron and move on and sell more iron. So I think it's the combination of these new technologies with new business models that's giving companies new life and new leverage.
Yeah, and I love what you talked about in terms of selling outcomes, because that's what I work on with my clients too, is because companies don't care about features or all the cool jargon that your technology does.
Feeds and feeds.
Yeah.
It doesn't matter anymore. They can get all that online.
Yeah.
You know, as a salesperson, it's about what I can do to get you to your goal. So I always look at the salespeople who latch on to some middle executive, figure out what the goals of that executive are, and then say, okay, here's how my product can make you look good and get your company to its goal. And that's an outcome. Mm-hmm. It's not the fact I have this widget. It's how is the widget going to transform your business?
Yeah, exactly. So that what you brought up about the 20-year contract in terms of the outcome for selling light or creating light, what like do they structure something in terms of ramifications if they don't execute on that? Or?
Well, sure, yeah, they have performance in there. I mean, it's like a SaaS contract, right? We guarantee to light the airport with so many lumens, you know, at an average cost over 20 years of X, and here are the penalties for service failures. I mean, it's very much like a SaaS outsourcing computer contract. There's a company in Germany that used to sell air compressors to business that needed, you know, compressed air in their factories. Now they sell air. They said, we'll supply this much air every month. Much more profitable for them, easier for the company. Company doesn't have to run the compressor and find people. They just buy air. So, you know, it's sort of componentizing manufacturing. We've done that in software, right? So software is now a collection of open source parts flying in the same direction. Mm-hmm. And you add a little bit of your own sauce on top. Now that's what's happening with manufacturing. I'm going to outsource these parts of my factory to somebody else who's selling me the light and selling me the air and selling me the fuel. And I'm the one who puts it all together and makes a widget.
So, yeah, and that's great. I love that analogy. And so what would you say is the number one mistake that companies make when they're looking at innovation and disruption?
Well, we talked about it. I think I'll give you an example. So I went to speak at a major insurance company. We spent all day with their 200 top execs talking about innovation. Everybody's pumped. We talked about culture and team and idea generation, idea selection. And then the chairman came in and said, well, this is all good, but don't run around with your hair on fire. You only innovate about these two things in the company. It was like, the air went out of the room because the guys in accounting had some ideas. Well, they can't, they were locked out and the guys in shipping were now locked out. And everybody's like, it's crazy. You need to let people go and innovate and celebrate those successes and celebrate the failures. Right. This is Ryan's idea. It failed. We're giving Ryan a better job because it was the project that failed. And innovation can happen anywhere. I was at another company, 100 years old. It was an insurance company. Before the meeting, this one came up and said, I did something innovative. I said, what was that? She said, well, I noticed that everybody had to handwrite their applications on a PDF. So I unlocked the PDF online so they could type it and just submit it. And that way we didn't even have to scan it. Right? We got the data. Now, I didn't want to tell her that that idea was so old that the IRS had done that like 5 years before. But it was innovation to them. And it made a huge difference. And she did it in her department. And nobody told her to. I mean, that's when you start getting accelerations in companies where people feel it's okay to try this and you won't kill me if I fail. And that has to come from the top down. You have to reach down as a leader and celebrate those successes and the failures. And then you'll start getting more ideas. At General Dynamics, they read about crowdsourced ideas. So they did this online crowdsourcing. We'll get ideas from everybody in the world. Half of the ideas came from their own employees. They just hadn't listened before.
The
ideas are there, but you have to be welcoming of those ideas and listen to them all the time. I mean, at Kayak, we didn't have a phone bank because we're a search company, but we did get emails. All the customer complaints went directly to the engineers. Mm-hmm. And you might think that's crazy because engineers earn a lot of money. But our slogan was give the pain to the people who cause the pain. And they listened and they fixed the code right away. Went, oh, it's just, as opposed to filtering it through other people, they can hear the customer's pain and they can innovate.
I've never heard of that before. So that's pretty cool. So tactically, let's take it one level deeper. How do you, and I know you said, from a leadership perspective, it's got to be supported from the top down, right? And then I love that example you're saying where you gave the problems to the people that caused them. And I didn't even probably word it the best possible way like you did. How do you tactically integrate that throughout your organization from the point in which you are, and it's easier obviously when you're smaller, right? As long as there's smaller people, you got the leader. But how do you integrate that into a day-to-day, week-to-week activity where you're celebrating the losses and also fostering innovation and disruption? So how do you integrate that into a culture? Because there's so many people like tech CEOs that I'm working with and they're listening that would love to hear that.
Well, there are a couple of things you could do. One of the things we did at American is, we had an incentive program for ideas. And in this case, we gave people goods. You could win a refrigerator, a mink coat, or whatever you wanted. Mink coat, that's dating it, a long time ago. And as part of that program, every new idea in a department was reviewed by the manager of the department and two managers of different departments. Because what we learned was, you might, for example, here's a real world example. So if you've flown on a regional jet, you know that many times you have to get off and walk across the tarmac in the rain or the snow to get to the airport.
Right.
Well, this guy invented that little walk the plank thing that they hook up to the regional jet now, so you can go on a jet bridge. And he proposed that to the maintenance department. And they said, ah, no, jet bridges are expensive. Nobody will want that. And we're out here in the rain. The customer should be too. You know, go away. Well, then we got this new program, and sales and marketing got to hear about that idea, and they approved it immediately because they said regional jets save us money. We want more people to fly on regional jets. This is a way to make them happy. So if you circulate ideas widely, you get them around the naysayer, you know, oh, this is a bad idea, who's usually the person in the department. I mean, you might even be proposing a change to the idea that got that person to be the manager. Mm-hmm. It's just that their idea now is 20 years old, and they don't want to change it. So circulate ideas widely is one. The other is, as you become a more agile organization, you can deliver products more quickly to the customer. So at Travelocity, we had, you know, an agile team that was delivering stuff every 6 weeks. We had new products for the customer. The stuff that took a year, that was done by different people because the customer doesn't care how much effort you put into it. They only care what they get. So we were constantly feeding them things every 6 weeks. So the customer said, well, Travelocity is pretty cool. Look at this new thing. Look at this new thing. Now, it might take a year to rewrite the underlying architecture, but that's okay. That was a different group. So that both the people in the company and the customer were seeing change all the time. I mean, that's why I love my Tesla, because every 6-8 weeks, I get a new car. You know, some new cool thing comes out. Every other car I had when I bought it, that was it. Now right. This car is changing all the time, which is part of this cloud-connected, customer-driven innovation. Which is so exciting because John Deere doesn't have to wait till the annual meeting to hear from the dealer what they think the farmer is doing. They watch mm-hmm. the farmer every day, and they can give the farmer something new so he becomes even more loyal to John Deere. So cloud-connected innovation with disparate products is driving everybody, even consumer products. I mean, Olay just came out with some connected makeup system. You know, everybody's trying to do that so they get real-time customer feedback.
That's great. I love those examples. And the 6 weeks versus the one-year team, I think that's excellent. How do you propose integrating that into the same kind of approach with sales and marketing?
Well, you know, the neat part about sales and marketing is that sales and marketing experiments all the time. And fails a lot. I mean, if you're in sales, you know how to fail because most of your new sales, you just get kicked in the head. So I don't think it's as hard as with other departments. You know, I've found that selling sales tools is much easier than selling tools to IT because mm-hmm. sales is constantly looking for the new edge. You know, what can I do to break down the door? But I think it also, you know, is your audience will see I'm the old gray beard here. I'm 70. Don't forget the old methods work, too. In my last company, I had a lot of young kids who were doing sales, and you know, it's this one guy said, well, why haven't you gotten in to see this customer? He said, well, I don't know. You know, I texted him and I emailed him and he didn't answer. Yeah. Did you like call him? Did you go take him to dinner? Did you do you do that? You know, it's like, yeah, you got to use every tool in the toolbox. Even direct mail still works, you know, anything to get in the door, is important, and you can't just, you know, your inbox is overflowing, theirs is worse. So what new innovative thing are you going to do to get in the door? You must be in sales almost more than any other part of the company. You have to be constantly evolving. I was talking to a bunch of sales guys from Arrow Electronics about 3 years ago, and I'm riding in the bus to the dinner before the speech. And I said, you know, what's changed? What's hard? And they said, and this was before COVID, mm-hmm. all the purchasing agents are working from home in their pajamas. We can't go see them anymore. We have to find a way to change. And they were just starting to use Zoom tools to do that. Of course, now, you know, everybody's done it. And we found that we can sell on Zoom, and we do. And that's going to be real interesting to see how that changes. Because I think I talked to an international consulting company last week. They had $100 million travel budget pre-COVID. They've cut it to 50.
Wow.
Wow. In consulting. In another company I'm on the board of, We used to send a salesperson and a sales engineer on every call. We deleted the engineer. The engineer is not going to go on video. So CFOs love all the money they saved on travel and dinners and stuff. And so it's going to be real interesting to see. I think that we've proven that relationships can be nurtured and continued through video. I don't know that we've proven how many new sales can be made on video once COVID is over. We're going to find out. In some cases, it works fine. I mean, hey, we just sold a multi-billion dollar company on video.
I'd say that's pretty good.
it works. But you know, can I really get in the door and see the person I want to see and help them out just on video? Maybe. You know, I think it'll continue to work.
Yeah, it will, because I've seen that and I talked to a lot of folks, and the more complicated the sales or what I see people struggling with are when there's a sales process, there's 10, 12 people, trying to, instead of having those one-off meetings after you have that group meeting, that's creating a different dynamic. We do have a question in the chat for Ben Parker as well, and we're getting close on time, but he was asking, he said, hey, Terry, great conversation. Do you think corporations are getting better or worse at innovating like startups?
Well, I think they're getting somewhat better. I think corporate venture capital, I'm not sure works. You know, some people invest to make money. Some people invest to listen well. You know, I think what's interesting are those companies who do what I call the Silicon Valley petting zoo. They go out to Silicon Valley and they look at a dozen startups. I was out with Ken Chenault, the former chairman of American Express, and he was doing it. And he said, I do it twice a year. And we either buy the companies or, you know, understand they're going to be a competitor, or we're inspired and, you know, kind of steal their ideas and go build it. I think that's what's important, is to keep your ear to the ground at what's happening, because, you know, 75% of startups fail. So they're not always the best ideas. But you look at Jamie Dimon's shareholder letter this week. He said, you know, fintech is going to come bite us in the jugular. We've got to change in finance. And fintech is coming. You look at Jeff Bezos just wrote his last shareholder letter as CEO because he's retiring. And, you know, it's about how do you add value. So I think there are companies who do it, and we're seeing these big announcements, you know, whether it's MassMutual into Bitcoin or the end of the internal combustion engine. You know, some of these companies are really understanding they have to change, but they're always the ossified old companies who say, well, you know, it'll never happen. I mean, look, the world's best candle company did not invent the light bulb. Right, they just improve the candle. It's pretty hard to move on. You heard the head of Toyota say electric cars will kill this industry, you know, and he's going to go the way of the buggy whip. You know, it's not going to work. Where other people were saying, we see it, we're changing. Look at British Petroleum just made the biggest bid ever for a wind farm. You know, because the big oil companies are saying we're in the energy business. But a couple of them are saying, oh, we're staying in oil. Okay. How do you make it work? At Valero, I spoke to Valero Oil, and you see their gas stations everywhere.
Oh, yeah.
Their most profitable product is reclaiming grease and oil from restaurants and making biofuels. And I talked to the guy who did that, and he said, I had so much trouble. You know, my damn oil didn't come out of the ground. Nobody understood what it was. And now I'm running the most profitable division. It was a huge battle, but the chairman was supportive, and now it works. And it has to come from the top.
Right. That's crazy. I mean, that's awesome. Not crazy. It's awesome. So it's crazy and awesome. So I'm just processing everything in real time, man. So we're just about up on time. Where can everybody find you? Where can they learn more about you?
Sure. Well, tbjones.com, T as in Tom, B as in boy, jones.com. tbjones.com is my website. You can find me there. There's tons of videos of speeches on all kinds of topics on innovation and change. My books on innovation and disruption off are available on Amazon in paperback, Kindle, and audiobook, narrated by me. So I think they're very unusual books. They're both 72 three-page chapters. So they're a cookbook. You can read them super fast. They're short-form media for today. It's a business book you'll actually finish. I'm a great speaker, virtual or in person. I'm fully vaccinated and giving my first in-person speech next week.
Nice.
So happy to come help your organization talk about innovation. And one thing I really do in those is heavily customized. So what I want to do is learn about your industry, learn about what you're doing, put that in my speech. I call my speech a jelly donut. Everyone has new jelly in it. The donut is kind of the same. So I want to make it relevant and useful for your team, because a lot of speeches are just, oh, you're the guy after lunch. And I want to be the guy where you walk away and say, I can do some of these things next week, because I don't need to do this. I want to do it to help corporations change.
Yeah. Yeah. And I encourage you, check out his website. I was checking it out in his speeches, which I haven't seen him do live, but they look absolutely amazing. It was like a visual light show and all the different slides. And so he does not disappoint on that side either. Also with your books, you have a quote at the beginning of every chapter as well, which is pretty cool. So absolutely love that. So, hey, it was a real pleasure having you on today, Terry. Love the perspective. And
thanks to everyone in the audience. And please reach out if I can help you.
And appreciate you, the listener, checking it out. So have a good one. Thank you for spending the time with me today. I know that time is one of the most valuable resources, so I truly honor and appreciate you coming along this journey with me. One of the things that I want to ask you is, if you really truly enjoyed this and know someone that this can make an impact on, please share this episode with them. If you're on a journey for financial and lifestyle freedom, it is always exponentially better if we're building a tribe with like-minded people who are on the same journey. In addition, I have an amazing PDF for you that could be career-changing in terms of the content. Essentially, what it is are the top 10 questions that every big customer is asking behind closed doors that no one is telling you about. I'll put a link for it in the show notes, so check it out. It's my free gift for you for being a part of this launch and being a part of this journey with me, and I hope to see you soon.